Easter Bunny.
Why do you hate the Easter Bunny? Didn't you get baskets and stuff in the hook when you were a kid?
He put a brick in it.
You're only going to see this on SmackDown. SmackDown's first ever pay-per-view vengeance.
Look at this Easter Bunny get his ass whooped. I love it.
You know, I just spent the last 15 minutes or so listening to the song Simple Man by Lynyrd Skynyrd on a loop. And I have to say, that is a goddamn great song. So anybody out there who is looking for a song to listen to and doesn't mind an oldie every now and then, it's not a song that I've heard too often before, but it really is a great song. This is episode 156, Solomonster Sounds Off here on SEScoops.com. It is Saturday, April 23rd, 2011. Solomonster here with you as always. Don't forget, those of you who are not following along on Twitter and Facebook, twitter.com/Solomonster is the place to go, and facebook.com/TheSolomonster. You can friend me on there and be part of all the fun. Also, just a word here to check out the latest mailbag on the main page at seScoops.com. It went up on Friday and is loaded up with a couple of good questions, and there's some interesting back-and-forth debating going on in the comments section right now as it relates to one Paul Heyman. Some people wondering what makes Paul Heyman so great. So check that out. It really is a good mailbag this week. I've got a story I want to talk about here, and I'm going to get to it in a second, and it concerns TNA. And before we do that, I may as well start with Lockdown. Last weekend, TNA's big all-cage match pay-per-view show, which I did not see, but I heard nothing but, I shouldn't say wonderful things. I've heard a lot of things about the Kurt Angle-Jeff Jarrett match, and I've heard mostly positive things about it, how it was such a great match, a lot of intensity, a lot of wacky, insane stuff, and I took it upon myself to at least make sure that I saw some of the crazier things that happened involving one Kurt Angle, who I believe on this show last week I referred to as being a machine. There is nobody in wrestling quite like Kurt Angle, never will be again. And there's both good and bad that goes along with that. Obviously, there was a spot during the match where I take it Jeff Jarrett attempted something of a powerbomb to Kurt Angle off the middle rope or the top rope, and Kurt perhaps over-rotated. Heard that Jarrett perhaps fucked up the move. Whatever the point was, Kurt avoided catastrophe in this match. I think a couple of inches more and perhaps he would have landed square on his head, broken his neck, again, perhaps killed himself. Thank God that did not happen. But I did see video of the insane moonsault that Kurt Angle executed from the top of the steel cage. A moonsault, mind you, that he pretty much missed. Even though Jeff Jarrett tried to move himself into position to make it look a little bit better, he missed the move. And it was absolutely insane for him to even attempt something like that. Supposedly, Jeff Jarrett suffered not broken, but bruised ribs during the match. Kurt Angle claimed that he suffered a separated shoulder, which I'm not sure if that's true or not. Although, again, if you watch just that one spot alone, I can only imagine some of the other abuse he took in that match. It's not hard to believe that Angle came away feeling a little worse for wear, but for the most part, apparently he's okay. And, you know, whenever I hear about Kurt Angle going out there and having a match like that, stealing the show and busting out some insane spot or some insane maneuver that he absolutely does not have to do, but he does it anyway. You know, it just makes me think that the reality is that the Kurt Angle story really only ends in one of two ways. The Kurt Angle story either ends with him dying, as he almost did last weekend, although through no fault of his own, dying in the middle of the ring, or he is paralyzed in the middle of the ring. And that's pretty much it. That's how the Kurt Angle story ends. When that happens, I don't know. Hopefully it won't happen for a long time. But you know, if you're Dixie Carter or Vince McMahon, you could do what baseball owners allegedly did with Barry Bonds and come to something of an understanding that nobody should hire this guy, you know, and essentially blackball him from the industry for his own sake, because you're never going to get him to stop. That's the problem with Kurt Angle. You know, it's in one ear and out the other. The only problem with that is you'll always have plenty of independent promoters who are willing to pay him to bring him in for a show, so inevitably he's going to end up killing himself in front of 50 people instead of 5,000. So essentially it's a no-win situation. I did like how apparently in the match Angle busted out an RKO and then went on Twitter to let Randy Orton know that he only did so out of respect. This is what Kurt Angle said. You know, meanwhile, I thought Angle said that he didn't even write those original tweets. I thought that somebody else did that, but apparently Kurt took credit for that one. So, anyway, all of this kind of ties into the top story here that I wanted to talk about. And it concerns TNA Wrestling's treatment of its talent. And more specifically, its female talent from the Knockouts division. Now, full credit here on this particular story, before I get into this here, goes to Cageside Seats. There is a story that is up on the Cageside Seats website. Of course, that is CagesideSeats.com. And the title of the story is The Sad Story of Shannon Daphne Spruill in TNA. So, of course, many of you know who Daphne is. She was in WCW, and I don't believe she was ever in WWE, but she was signed many years ago by TNA. She may have had an initial stint and then came back. I don't really remember, but she was in TNA. She was the screaming goth girl, although when TNA brought her in a while back, it was to play the role of the governor, basically a spoof on Sarah Palin. Of course, that was goddamn awful. It didn't really go anywhere. And then thankfully they shed that gimmick and kind of let her be herself. And what ended up happening is Daphne suffered multiple injuries while on the job in TNA. And really, if you really look at it, in most cases, it wasn't necessarily her fault. But she really got banged up pretty bad in her time with TNA. Now, in her case, what ended up happening was Daphne's contract had come up for expiration, and TNA chose not to renew her deal. And at the time, as the article points out, Daphne had gone online and posted that her picture had been taken down from the TNA roster page. She mentioned that her contract was expiring and TNA was not renewing it. And she said at the time that she did not know if that had anything at all to do with the fact that she had filed a workers' comp claim against the company for injuries that she sustained in the ring on the job. And her lawyers advised her to not go into any more details at that particular time. And basically, if you take the article in totality, and there was an article many months ago that was on this same website, written by people who, you know, again, allegedly, I have to say allegedly, have some sources within TNA. Although many of this, you know, many of what is written here has been either corroborated or also alluded to by other wrestling websites in terms of certain lawsuits being filed by different people against the company. So, yes, take all of this with a grain of salt. Nothing is ever 100% confirmed. Certainly TNA won't confirm any of this. But what I read here, I choose to believe, and as such, I choose to comment on this. So let me just put that out there first and foremost. The list of injuries that Daphne sustained since she came to TNA in late 08, obviously one of the worst things was an injury that she sustained at the Bound for Glory pay-per-view back in 2009. You may recall that she had been chokeslammed on that pay-per-view from the ring apron by Abyss onto a barbed wire board on the outside. It was a stupid, stupid spot. And, you know, certainly if I were Daphne, I would have thought twice about doing it. But again, put yourself in the position of a Daphne or one of the female performers in the company. And if you're being pressured or asked by the company to do something, more often than not, you're going to do it, especially if you feel that perhaps your job is riding on that. And she suffered a very serious concussion on that spot, was taken to the hospital. She suffered another concussion in a feud that she had with Tara in TNA when she got hit in the head with a toolbox. She suffered a bruised sternum, a severe stinger, and another concussion in what is a pretty infamous incident that involved somebody by the name of Miss Betsy, might know her as Miss Betsy or Rosie Lotalov. She was a student from the Team 3D Wrestling School who was trained by Bubba, or Bubba and Devon, I guess. And it was a dark match at a set of Impact tapings, I believe, last year. And basically, it was a botched sunset flip. And Miss Betsy landed on Daphne. It was not Daphne's fault, by all accounts. But Daphne got the worst of it. Boy, did she ever. She, as I mentioned, sustained numerous injuries as a result of that. Now, I want to go back to the Bound for Glory thing for a second, because this is really the heart of the story here. Daphne, of course, was asked to do this spot. And again, I'm quoting now from the article. She was asked to do the spot. She would go through a table full of tacks. She was obviously very hesitant, as anybody would have been. And, of course, Terry Taylor, who works in talent relations for TNA, basically told her that she would be fine, she would be taken care of, it would not be a problem. So there was a lot of convincing that had to be done from both Terry Taylor and Vince Russo, who was apparently telling her how important the spot was for the feud that was going on. And, of course, she went through with it, and she got hurt. And she was treated at the hospital. She was taken there via ambulance. Meanwhile, Spike TV did not even allow footage of any of this to air on their TV show. They have a policy of banning violence against women. And, obviously, a huge bill from the hospital came out of all this for Daphne. Now, she went back and forth with the company about this. For many months, TNA would not pay the hospital bill. And apparently there are emails that exist that went back and forth between Daphne and Terry Taylor. And Terry Taylor forwarded those emails to certain people within the company and basically told her that it was being taken care of and not to worry about it. So keep that in mind, that TNA did not come right out of the chute and say, listen, we have a policy that, you know, the wrestlers are responsible for their own bills, their own surgeries and whatnot. We can't help you. You take care of it. Apparently, that did not happen at the get-go. Okay, she was given the impression that it would be taken care of. This was something they pressured her into doing. She did it. She got hurt. So naturally, it would make sense that TNA would take care of this hospital bill. Long story short, this went on for a long time. And at the end of the day, TNA came back to her and said, basically, you're on your own. We're not paying your hospital bill. Now, this is not the first time that stories have come out about TNA treating its talent that way. I mean, there have been numerous stories involving performers over the years who were hurt on the job, perhaps needed surgery or a hospital bill paid, and TNA basically would just stonewall them, would drag it out as long as possible. Maybe in some cases they ended up paying it, in many cases they did not. And apparently one of the excuses that was given by TNA, including to Daphne, was that the longer they wait, the less money they may be able to come out of this having to pay. Okay, so that's why they opted to drag these things out. And in Daphne's case, they never even bothered paying for the hospital bill. The incident with Miss Betsy, the injuries that Daphne sustained, again, TNA, refusing to pay for her medical bills. Another story that gets shared where Daphne suffers another concussion working with Angelina Love in a tag team match. This was apparently during the holiday TV tapings in December. And, you know, this happens on day one of about 5 days' worth of tapings. Daphne goes to Terry Taylor. She goes to management, tells him about the injury, and they tell her that she can work the next couple of days. She'll be fine. Now, mind you, this is at the same time that TNA was doing that storyline, that absurd storyline on TV with Mr. Anderson, who also was out with a legitimate concussion, courtesy of a Jeff Hardy chair shot to the back of the head. They were doing this concussion storyline on television and, you know, basically talking about how it's important to make sure that, you know, you take these injuries seriously and concussions are a serious thing. And they were talking, you know, they even cited Chris Nowinski's Sports Legacy Institute. So it seemed like TNA was taking the matter seriously when, in actuality, it was quite a hypocritical stance for them to take. Here's a performer that is telling you she's hurt, she's telling you she's concussed. And you're basically telling her, eh, it's okay, don't worry about it, you can continue to work. The Miss Betsy thing actually is something that they did air on TV. I guess they, you know, in an attempt to get her over as being something of an Awesome Kong type of monster. And mind you, here's a woman who was brought in a tryout match who severely injured a contracted TNA performer, and they reward her by basically giving her a contract. And when they realized that basically this woman didn't know what the fuck she was doing, they finally let her go. It took them long enough to figure that out. Anyway, the point of all this is Daphne is only one case. Apparently there are other lawsuits either pending or perhaps about to be filed against TNA by either current or former talent that allege various infractions when it comes to the way that they treat their performers. And it's something that, you know, I've read stories about this before, and I never really paid too much attention to it. And a lot of times it's one person's word against the company. But now there's a pattern of behavior that is developed. And what really upset me about this was, I don't remember what I was listening to. I was listening to an interview recently and on a different show. And talk turned to TNA. And, you know, I don't remember exactly what the whole conversation was about, but the point was that no matter what you want to say about TNA and how awful the product may be and this and that, that Dixie Carter is a very nice woman who cares about her talent. And it makes me very angry when I hear people talking about that, about Dixie's such a nice lady. She's clueless when it comes to wrestling, but, you know, she cares about the talent and this and that. And TNA gives people a platform. If they can't get to WWE, it's an opportunity for them to get on TV. And that may well be true. But there is a laundry list of different situations from over the last couple of years that really illustrate how little TNA thinks of its talent. And it's not just the female performers, although by and large it is the female performers. Now, off the top of my head, I jotted down a list of things that I have read and I've heard over the last couple of years just to give examples of how TNA treats its talent. And really, you can even go back to Gail Kim. Now, Gail Kim obviously is currently under contract to WWE. She was originally in WWE many years ago. As a matter of fact, on her first night in the company, she became the women's champion in what I believe was a battle royal on Raw. And Gail Kim was one of the better performers on the WWE roster for many years. And then one day, she was released from her contract inexplicably. I remember it like it was yesterday at the time. I was floored by that. I couldn't believe they let her go. And a lot of people were just flabbergasted by that whole thing. There was no stories of her having heat with management, of her having done anything wrong backstage. Her work was solid. She was one of the bigger stars in their women's division. To this day, it is a mystery why Gail Kim was let go by World Wrestling Entertainment. So Gail Kim goes to TNA, and What ends up happening is Gail Kim, along with Awesome Kong, really are the two people responsible for making, I can't even say resuscitating, I mean, they were the two women who helped make that Knockouts division in TNA what it was. And what it was, once upon a time, was the hottest commodity in the entire company. The Kong-Kim feud was one of the biggest things in all of TNA at one point. Consistently, the women on the roster, their segments at that time were the highest rated things on Impact. And we know how much TNA and the people who run that company, they live and die by that weekly Impact rating, to the point where they really don't even care. They truly don't care about their pay-per-view buy rates. It's all about ratings. And the women were getting the highest rated segments on the entire show. The Knockouts division was truly a hot commodity at one point. And Gail Kim, I don't know, I don't recall if her deal was coming up for renewal. I think maybe it was coming up for renewal, but she wanted more money. And quite frankly, she probably deserved it. But apparently she was getting paid quite a paltry sum. And she felt that for the work that she and the other Knockouts were doing in the company, she deserved a little bit better. Now, Gail Kim wanted very much to stay in TNA. She made that very clear. She made a lot of friends in that company. She obviously had been let go by WWE years earlier for reasons that I bet she didn't even understand. So it's not like Gail Kim couldn't wait to get out of TNA. She very much wanted to stay. She just wanted them to show in some way, shape, or form. And obviously the best way to show that is by rewarding your talent with a pay raise. She wanted them to show that they cared, and that way she would be able to stay in the company. And what ended up happening was she was given apparently a very insulting offer. Perhaps multiple insulting offers by TNA. And even though it wasn't something she really wanted to do, she realized what she had to do to support herself was leave, which she did, and she ended up signing a contract to go back to WWE. And I will say that in her time back in WWE, especially more so when she first came back, Gail Kim did not look all that great in the ring. I'm not quite sure what happened, if it was nerves, if it was having to adjust to the quote, WWE style, but Gail Kim wasn't exactly lighting the women's division on fire when she came back to WWE, but she's gotten better again over time. It's not like, you know, you go to one place, you're a great performer, and then you forget everything when you go to a different company. But nonetheless, WWE was smart enough to scoop her up and sign her to a contract, and she's been with the company ever since, even though WWE has absolutely done nothing with her. I mean, they have done shit with Gail Kim since bringing her back. And with Kong coming into WWE, I mean, perhaps they'll put the two of them back together and let them have a program with one another. But anyway, the point is, TNA basically spit in the face of Gail Kim. And that is why she left the company. And then you have a different situation with Taylor Wilde, who has since retired. But Taylor Wilde, at one point, was one of the hottest knockouts in TNA. Literally and figuratively. And there are stories of her having a side job at Starbucks, because what she was being paid by her TNA deal was not enough to live on. She had to find employment elsewhere and come up with a side job to support herself. And apparently she was working at a Starbucks, and one day a customer recognized her. And at the time, she was one half of the Knockout Tag Team Champions. And I guess this person asked her, hey, are you, you know, one of the TNA Knockout Champions? And anyway, I guess she ended up quitting that job. You know, it was an embarrassing situation. And I've heard other stories of TNA talents, more so the women, needing to work on the side. There was another story I heard about one of the Knockouts, I think, having to work in a mall kiosk. Again, this is how these women support themselves, because what TNA pays them is shit. There was, of course, the incident from October of 2009. I went back to look up the date. I couldn't remember if it was last year or the year before. Apparently it was in 2009. It was on an episode of Impact, the Impact tapings. There was a match between the Motor City Machine Guns and Team 3D. And in that match, Chris Sabin took a very nasty bump while he was working with Brother Ray. And I believe he may have suffered a stinger, or was feared, perhaps, that he had suffered a stinger. It was a very scary situation. And I remember reading the Impact taping results, and a lot of people were very upset, because it was quite obvious when it happened that Sabin had suffered a very serious injury, or was certainly shaken up to a very large degree. And the match just kept on going. They were told, keep going, keep the match going, which is exactly what happened. I think, you know, they kind of just rolled him out to the side, and I guess the way that it was handled was perhaps not the best way to handle that situation. And Kevin Nash, of all people, was very upset at how TNA handled that situation. And he was actually out there later on in that show to conduct an interview. And what Nash ended up doing, which I don't believe ever aired on TV, I'm pretty sure they cut his segment or edited it. But basically he went out there and shot all over TNA. He cut a shoot about how upset he was, about how TNA doesn't know how to treat its talent. It was just a bad situation all around. And TNA, you know, you can argue that Nash was very unprofessional in what he did, but obviously if Kevin Nash was that bothered by it, to the point where he actually went out there and shot on his own company in front of the audience about their mistreatment of its own talent, Nash was not the only one who felt that way at that time. There's the infamous Rob Terry chair shot from an Impact match. I believe it was Homicide, if I'm not mistaken, who delivered a ridiculously wicked chair shot to the skull. And again, this was at a time where things like that were being toned down, they were being eliminated. The things that are known now about, you know, chair shots and blunt force to the head. And again, TNA even created a storyline with Mr. Anderson based around concussions and making sure that, you know, people who suffer a concussion are well taken care of, and you don't want to exacerbate the injury. And here's this match and this spot on Impact where Homicide delivers this chair shot that I'm surprised poor Rob Terry's head didn't explode. And a lot of people, again, were very angry with TNA when that happened. Go back to May of last year, almost a year ago, on an episode of Impact. Abyss is out there with Desmond Wolfe for a segment. Abyss has his arm sliced open with shards of glass from a broken bottle. Why? I guess to make the angle feel more realistic. And mind you, it was real glass. And Abyss's arm was indeed ripped open was bleeding all over the place like a stuck pig. Jeff Hardy at Victory Road a few months ago, need I say more? Of course, now TNA wants Jeff to go to rehab. Well, that's rich. I'm glad that they want him to go to rehab now. Apparently, they didn't bother really pushing him in that direction up until this point, even though Jeff Hardy has had other incidents in the past before what happened at Victory Road. It's not like Victory Road was the first time that opened their eyes, that perhaps there's a problem here with one of our biggest stars, and perhaps that, perhaps he should have this taken care of and address this. It wasn't until Jeff Hardy went out there and essentially embarrassed TNA. But you see, I would argue differently. Jeff Hardy didn't embarrass TNA. TNA embarrassed TNA when that happened. TNA embarrasses itself just by its mere existence. So again, a laundry list of different situations. Ineptitude by TNA, absolutely. A callous attitude towards its own talent? Well, it certainly would seem that way to me. And the Daphne story just made me flip my lid when I read this, because I knew that Daphne had fired a workers' comp claim towards the company. I didn't know all the details about it. And again, there's more details in this article. I'm not going to read the whole thing verbatim. So I would advise you, highly advise you, to go read this article on the CagesideSeats.com website. And I'll tell you this. I hope that TNA loses. I really do. I hope Daphne wins her case. And again, there's other cases apparently potentially pending against the company. I hope TNA loses, and I hope they lose bad. Because that's the only way that there's ever going to be a change in this company. Now, there's also been rumors, and I stress rumors because I don't know if this is 100% accurate or not, that Dixie Carter has essentially been removed from power, or has stepped down from her post, at least temporarily. Why? Well, take your pick. Some people would say that it's because of the Jeff Hardy situation, you know, after that whole just clusterfuck of what happened at Victory Row. You'll notice that Dixie Carter has been absent from Twitter. She used to Twitter up quite a bit, and she really hasn't had anything to say since that pay-per-view. Of course, that was when she was overwhelmed by negative feedback after that whole fiasco. But there's been a lot of rumors going around the last couple of weeks, a lot of which I don't necessarily buy into, that Dixie has been removed as the president of TNA, which I don't believe that to be true, because we would have heard something by now, that her mother, Janice Carter, has essentially taken over her role, and she's tightening the reins in terms of costs at TNA and trying to really essentially take over her daughter's position, which I don't know if that's a good thing or not. You know, the big knock on Dixie Carter has been that she doesn't know the wrestling business, and she's just not a good wrestling promoter. She's in way over her head. And I have no reason to believe that her mother would be any better than she would. But again, I don't know if any of that is true. But what I was getting at is, there's been some speculation that Dixie, essentially, if she hasn't been removed from her post, has really been laying low for the last month and a half. In light of these allegations, in light of the Daphne case, in light of a lot of these different things coming to light. Because it makes TNA look so horrible. A company that cares about its performers would take every precaution necessary to ensure the safety of its performers. It would show its performers that it actually cares. And TNA has done none of that. And I want to say this, for all the people who knock WWE, and WWE is far from a perfect company, okay? And Vince McMahon himself is not exactly a patron saint. But nobody can argue that the WWE wellness policy, for example, has not done good things for that company, has not been a positive for its performers, that potentially lives and careers potentially have been saved or lengthened because of the efforts of the wellness policy, which is far from a perfect policy. But then you look at TNA, who claims to have their own drug testing policy, but yet they will release absolutely no details about it at all. Now, they're a private company, so they certainly don't have to if they don't want to, but it just makes them look that much worse. They tell absolutely nothing about their drug testing policy, but they make it a point to say that we have one. So basically, we have a drug testing policy. We're not going to tell you anything about it. We're not going to tell you how it works. We're not going to tell you what we test for. We're not going to tell you how often we test our performers. We're not going to tell you what happens when somebody does fail a test. We're not going to tell you if anybody has ever been suspended or released from the company as a result of a failed test. Just take our word for it that we have a policy and it works. That's essentially the TNA argument. And obviously, I call bullshit on that argument. You look at WWE. Vince McMahon has done a lot of stupid things recently, okay? Especially in the last couple of weeks. He's made a lot of very, how shall I say, confusing decisions. Troubling decisions. But you cannot deny that WWE has taken other measures to tone down their product and ensure the safety of its performers. They put a ban on blading. Okay, so blood is essentially banned. You know, every now and then people will get busted open hard way. And they seem to be a little more lenient when that happens in terms of allowing that to air on TV. You know, CM Punk got his nose busted up a while back and they showed that on TV. And somebody gets busted up in the mouth. It's not like they're going to stop the match. But blading and bleeding essentially is a banned thing now in WWE. And I think there's a place for it. There's a time and a place for it. But at the same time, I respect the company for taking a stand on that. They said, you know what? This is a practice that we just do not want to have that as part of our product anymore. We will not allow our performers to go out there and slice themselves open for the sake of the entertainment, and therefore, we're simply not going to do it anymore. And if somebody does get busted open in the course of a match, we're going to stop the match, tend to the wound to make sure the performer is safe before we continue the action. And again, I don't always agree with it, but nonetheless, it's a preventative measure that was taken by the company to ensure the safety of its performers. Now, all of these different things, the blood ban, the ban many years ago on using pile drivers, which has been in effect for many years. Every now and then they'll allow it, you know, somebody like a Shawn Michaels to bust out a pile driver in a match. Very, very, very rare that you will see a performer allowed to use a pile driver. There's other banned moves in WWE. Why are they banned? Well, they're banned to protect the performers. They're not banned for any other reason but the safety of the performers. You know, it was a long time before Evan Bourne convinced Vince McMahon to allow him to do the shooting star press on television, because that was also a banned move for a period of time. You know, WWE has what they call their impact testing, which is a legitimate program. It's used if somebody suffers a concussion, like John Cena did recently. There's a certain protocol that you have to go through to make sure that you are fully recovered before you are allowed to get back in the ring. I am aware of no such program in TNA. Apparently, if you suffer a concussion, unless you are a big star like a Mr. Anderson and they want to protect their investment, usually you're probably just going to be told to just get back in the ring and basically keep your mouth shut. Now, you know, when Vince McMahon went before Congress, there was a private session, and you may remember this, and Vince was grilled for hours on Capitol Hill. He was in there with Jerry McDevitt, his legal representative, and at one point he was asked about, I don't remember if it was specifically about the wellness policy, or it may have been about WWE's policy, where each year they put a letter out. And this letter goes out to all of their talent that has ever worked for the company, past or present. As long as they have your address and they have your information, you get this letter in the mail every single year. And it's basically WWE's offer to send anybody that has ever worked for their company to rehab if they have some sort of substance abuse issue. Now, Vince McMahon, I believe, was asked about that and why the company does that. If their argument, as WWE's argument before has been, if their argument is that, well, we don't tell our talent to take drugs or to get dependent on this or dependent on that, or this person hasn't worked for us in X number of years, then why then do you feel compelled to do this or to offer this service, which is a very nice thing for WWE to do, and they don't have to do it, but they do it. And Vince McMahon's answer, just in the interest of being fair here, his answer was verbatim, we do it for PR. That's what Vince McMahon said. Those were his exact words. He admitted, we're doing this for public relations purposes. So again, Vince McMahon, I appreciate his honesty. He's not a saint. Not everything he does is out of the goodness of his heart. But nonetheless, he and his company are doing things that are positive. And TNA can certainly take a lesson from that. But TNA doesn't even have to copy what WWE is doing. And I understand that TNA doesn't have the same financial resources that WWE has. They can't afford to help every single person in that respect, nor should they. But when it comes to stories like this of people who have worked for them being treated like fucking dog shit, women who are treated like dog shit, who go out there, they bust their ass, You know, whether it's they're underpaid or underappreciated, I mean, whether that's the case or not, there is a laundry list of examples to prove that TNA does not give a fuck about its performers. And I think that they should pay for that. So like I said, I hope that Daphne wins her case. I hope her suit is a success and that TNA has to pay her a lot of money and that TNA is forced to change their business practices. And the next time that somebody says, well, Dixie Carter does care about her performers, I would like for that person to give me one example to prove why TNA cares about its talent. Give me one good example of how TNA shows that they care for and appreciate its talent. I would love to hear this. TNA needed to be called out on their business practices. I said my piece. That's all I'm going to say about that. Check out the article, the full article, on cagesideseats.com. It's a great read. It's a maddening, angering read, but it's an important thing to read nonetheless. And I'm going to have a couple of more TNA news bits later on in the show. But right now we're going to kind of break the monotony up here a little bit. Talk a little bit of WWE. There's a draft you may have heard coming up this week. Raw this coming Monday from Raleigh, North Carolina, will feature the annual WWE draft. And anybody who's listened to this show for any length of time knows my thoughts in general whenever WWE does a draft, because they don't bother to really truly separate the brands. And in fact, in the lead up to WrestleMania, it was almost comical the way that people from SmackDown would be on Raw without any explanation at all, and people from Raw would be on SmackDown, and that's fine. I mean, if that's what WWE wants to do, I certainly have no problem with it. If they wanted to abolish the brand split as we know it, you can still unofficially keep certain talents more specific to the Raw brand, for example, or to the SmackDown brand, but don't have an official separation of the brands and just let them commingle a little more often. Again, kind of like what they were doing before WrestleMania. It would certainly open things up to some fresher feuds if they wanted to do that. But instead, they still maintain that Raw is its own brand and SmackDown is its own brand, and we have to have a draft, as if the draft means a goddamn thing. To the wrestlers, it does, because, you know, when guys get drafted to a different show, they follow a different travel schedule, and if they have friends or travel partners, let's say, on Raw, and they move to SmackDown, it can change somebody's life. So to them, it's an important thing. But I'm just saying, in terms of the product itself, it's a fucking joke. Anybody out there who would argue the draft actually does mean something, I would argue that it doesn't. But there's a draft on Monday. It's still fun, of course, to postulate who might be going where. And, of course, this draft was originally going to take place in June on a three-hour edition of Raw. Now, usually, over the last couple of years, these draft shows are 3 hours in length. And apparently, this was bumped up by Vince McMahon to this week in light of Edge's injury and sudden retirement. This is a normal two-hour edition of Raw, and they're going to fit the whole draft in there. And I assume there's going to be a supplemental draft as well on WWE.com a day or two later. That's usually how they work it. Now, there's going to be a ton of different people moving around. So these picks that I'm about to mention here are by no means things that I think are these are not going to be the only moves. There's going to be a ton of different people moving around. People who I'm not even about to list here. Lower card talent. Perhaps they will swap the champions. I've heard a rumor that, you know, perhaps they'll move Del Rio to Raw and move The Miz over to SmackDown, that Alberto was supposedly going to go to Raw in the draft in June anyway. Obviously, being that it was bumped up by 2 months and Del Rio has not yet won the World Heavyweight Championship, although I think he will at Extreme Rules, perhaps they'll change their mind. Maybe Del Rio will not move. I don't know. But if I were booking the draft, if I thought there were some key moves to make here, this is a list of the moves that I would make. Again, by no means is this all of them, but obviously Edge losing, or rather SmackDown losing Edge, big blow. I mean, a huge blow to SmackDown. Edge was the biggest star on that brand, aside from The Undertaker. And let's be honest, The Undertaker is part-time at best. He has not been seen since WrestleMania. He may not be seen again until SummerSlam. He is not a full-time performer he does not help SmackDown by not being there. Edge was the champion. Edge was their top babyface. Edge was very important to the show. And him being gone means that SmackDown needs all the help that it can get. And really, SmackDown is in dire need of a big babyface, because Christian, you know, Christian is a very good babyface. He's a better heel, in my opinion, but he's a very good babyface. But even I have to admit, Christian is not a guy who's going to be able to carry SmackDown on his own. And Vince McMahon certainly does not look at Christian that way either. So if Christian is not going to be your top babyface, that leaves you with what? Rey Mysterio? Big Show? That's about it. What I would do is this. It's obvious that the two top baby faces in the company are on the same show. You have John Cena, who is the face of the company, like it or not, and you have Randy Orton, who is essentially positioned at a level just below John Cena. Now, Orton is in this feud with CM Punk. He's now got two pretty much clean pinfall wins over Punk, one at WrestleMania, one from Raw this past Monday. They're going to have their blow-off match, or at least what I hope is their blow-off match at Extreme Rules. It's going to be a last-man-standing match. And they're really, when I think about it, when Punk's feud with Orton ends, unless he is put back into a feud for the WWE title with The Miz, which is the last thing I think that anybody wants to see, been there, done that, what do you do with Orton? Where does he go if he stays on the Raw brand? Who does he feud with? I certainly don't want to see him back with John Cena. You've done The Miz feud. You've got Punk. Who else? You know, what is he going to do? And really, is there a need to have both him and Cena on the same show? I say no. So obviously, the most obvious move to make, if you're going to move one big name, at least, over to SmackDown, that name would be Randy Orton. Which is not to say that I wouldn't mind seeing John Cena off my TV on Monday nights, but it ain't going to happen. So I would move Randy Orton over to SmackDown, but I wouldn't stop there. You've got a hot new star on Raw by the name of Sin Cara. And originally, I was of the impression that he would be starting out on the SmackDown brand. And it was very surprising when I found out that he was going to be on Raw. And in fact, for the month of May, he is listed on the Raw lineups. I think he's doing some tag matches with Evan Bourne or something. And I'm sure that it was certainly in the plans for him to remain on Raw for the foreseeable future. But again, Edge's retirement, the sudden draft, things change. I think Sin Cara would be a much better fit for SmackDown. And part of that is a selfish reason on my part, because I personally would love to see some sort of interaction with him and Rey Mysterio. Not yet. Still a little early for that. But to do that, both of them need to be on the same show. I think Mysterio and Sin Cara should be on the same brand. At some point, they should be doing some tag matches together. And eventually, I would love to see the two of them face off in a program. Even if both of them are baby faces, I think it would make for some really fun matches. You know, Mysterio obviously knows how to work the lucha style if they want to go in that direction. There's a lot that you can do with those two guys, and Mysterio can help give him the rub too. I mean, Sin Cara is doing a pretty good job of getting over with the fans, but you know, getting that little extra rub from Rey Mysterio and almost like a passing of the torch type of situation, although Rey is not going anywhere yet. I think that Sin Cara should be moved over to SmackDown. Plus, let's be honest, I mean, he's had some really good matches on Raw so far, but he's looked a little rough around the edges. You know, he's still getting used to wrestling in a WWE ring, and they've made him tone down a lot of his stuff from Mexico, and he's got to conform to the WWE style. And, you know, I think back to his first match, that big botch at the end. It wasn't really his fault as much as it was Primo's fault, but still, you could save yourself a lot of grief if you're going to have these issues with Sin Cara's matches by putting him on a brand with a taped show instead of a live show. So again, to me, move him over to SmackDown. SmackDown needs all the help it can get. You can move over Randy Orton, but you got to do more than that. And Sin Cara is a guy who, again, who is he going to feud with on Raw? You know, I could see him in a U.S. title feud, for example, with Sheamus. Maybe he does some stuff with Punk. I don't think they would do anything quite yet with him and Miz. Move him over to SmackDown. It would really help them out a lot if you move those two guys over. Now, Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan is a guy who, when he is in there, he has great matches most of the time. When he's in there with Sheamus, they've had some really good matches. He's been in there with DiBiase, they've had some really good matches. Him and Miz have a backstory. I would love for them to do something with Daniel Bryan and The Miz. And it's obvious to me that they're just not going to do that. And if that's the case, and if Daniel Bryan has been basically reduced to being a part of Santino Marella's apple, even if it was just for 1 week, the fact that he came out there with all those... I don't want to insult them, but let's be honest here. Santino and Kozlov and Mark Henry, they're not exactly the cream of the crop on Raw. And when I saw him come out with them a couple of weeks ago, it just made me shake my head. Because Daniel Bryan's a guy, small as he may be, he goes out there and the fans get into his matches. He can be as big a star as you want him to be if you give him a little bit of a push. And I think that he may have used up all of his cred, so to speak, on Raw. I just don't see them getting behind him like they did at first. He's done all that he can do at this point on Raw. It's obvious they're not going to do jack shit with him going forward. Why not move him over to SmackDown? Move him over to SmackDown, you give him some fresh talent to work with on that show. He can get over as a babyface. SmackDown needs more babyface guys. And let's be honest here now. If Alberto Del Rio ends up becoming World Heavyweight Champion, okay, and the feud with Christian runs its course, you can go back to Del Rio and Mysterio. Maybe the two of them feud over the title and Del Rio wins. Obviously, you can then do Del Rio and Randy Orton. I could see Del Rio and Daniel Bryan somewhere down the road. I could see that working. Not that they would put the belt on Bryan, but I could see where that would get over. They're both talented enough guys where that could be a big-time feud on SmackDown. And Daniel Bryan will end up being a bigger star there than he ever would be on Raw. He's not doing anything on Monday nights. Get him off that show. Move him over to Friday nights. Now, two other names here that I just want to throw in here. I haven't heard too many people talking about Skip Sheffield, who, of course, was one of the members of the NXT Season 1 cast. He was part of the original Nexus faction. I remember when I saw this guy for the first time on NXT, and he had that kind of goober cowboy gimmick. He looked ridiculous, let's put it that way. I don't want to insult him too badly, because if he ever hears this, he'll beat the shit out of me. But Skip Sheffield turned into a monster as part of the Nexus on Raw. And it was to the point where I really thought that this guy could be the next. I don't want to compare him to a Bill Goldberg or a Brock Lesnar, because he's not Brock Lesnar. But what I mean by that is this big, strong, tough, scary-looking dude who just goes in there and plows over people, just mows them down. Again, you book him the right way, you could book him as a monster. He could be a big thing down the road, a big deal. And apparently Vince McMahon feels the same way, because Vince McMahon has commented that he sees Skip Sheffield potentially as, I believe the quote was, being a number two babyface behind John Cena. I don't know. That might be a little further down the road. Unfortunately, the guy got hurt. And I think that ultimately when the first Nexus faction broke up, you could have had a situation on your hands very similar to what ended up happening with Batista in Evolution, where the plan was to build to a Triple H Randy Orton match at WrestleMania. They had their sights set on Orton being the next big deal. And what ended up happening was Batista got over. He got over in a big way. Ended up winning the Royal Rumble, split from Evolution, beat Triple H at WrestleMania 21 for the championship. WrestleMania 21 on pay-per-view did very well. Because Batista, that whole story of him and the tension between him and Triple H, it got over in a big way. And Batista was never the best wrestler in the world. He had a great look. He was this big, jacked-up dude. But the people got behind him. And I think you could have had a similar deal in your hands with Skip Sheffield, perhaps, when Nexus ultimately disintegrated. Perhaps you could have built something with him and Wade Barrett, and then he breaks out of the pack and beats them all up and becomes this big babyface monster. But he broke his ankle in a match, and we haven't seen him since. Now, originally, it was supposed to be 6 months out, and he'd be back. And that would have been in February. So I assume by now, he's probably 100%, and they're just waiting to slot him back in. So don't be surprised if Skip Sheffield, his name comes up and he fits in somewhere in this draft, whether it's on TV or maybe in the supplemental draft. I would move him over to SmackDown and you know, start letting him plow through some people on that brand. He certainly, in my opinion, has more potential than an Ezekiel Jackson, who maybe it's just the way that they're handling him. He just seems like this big, clumsy guy who doesn't have a lot of charisma. He doesn't really impress me that much. Skip Sheffield, it's too early to tell, but I think there's something there. You could do something with him. Zack Ryder is the other name I wanted to mention here. A guy that probably should be taken off of Raw, although he's never on Raw, but taken off the Raw brand and perhaps given a chance on SmackDown. And obviously he's not a babyface, although he's getting over like one with the crowd. He has this kind of underground swell of support. There's been a ton of Zack Ryder signs on TV. He has these YouTube videos, which I didn't really pay any attention to at first, but I've actually become a really big fan of these videos. They're very well done. They're very creative. And now, again, there's other people like Curt Hawkins who are kind of copying and trying to ride his coattails, and they've got their own YouTube videos. And I don't know how wise it is. You know, I don't know how WWE will look at something like that, but to me, they're a hell of a lot more entertaining than most of the backstage comedy crap that you'll see on Raw any given week. What I would do with Zack Ryder is, if they actually were going to do something with the guy, this is a guy who probably could do very well with his own talk show segment on Raw, very much like Chris Jericho had the highlight reel, and Edge had the cutting edge, Carlito had his cabana. Why not give Zack Ryder his own segment where he can go out there? He's got a lot of personality, a lot of charisma, and he can interview guys. You know, take his Z True Long Island story and essentially turn it into something on Raw. I mean, maybe you could even air those videos and air those vignettes with some better production values, obviously. Take it to the next level. But maybe air those types of segments on Raw each week. You know, if you don't want to give him a talk show segment. But you could do stuff with this guy. And this is a guy that a year ago I would have written off and said, listen, this guy's on the chopping room, on the cutting room floor. He's on the chopping block. You know, get rid of him. He's coming out there with one pant leg, you know, half his leg exposed. I don't know what he's trying to accomplish. He's not that entertaining. And in actuality, as we've, and this is probably a great example of something much larger than just Zack Ryder. When you take a guy like this who doesn't seem on the surface to be very entertaining, and you give him a shot, you give him a platform, not everybody is going to prove you wrong, but probably 6-7 times out of 10, this guy's going to turn around and you know, he's going to show you something that you never saw in him before because he never had a chance to show it. I think Zack Ryder is one of those guys, and if they're not going to do anything with him on the A show, then maybe move him over to the B show, give him a talk show segment, give him a little mid-card push, maybe put him in something with Kofi Kingston or something, Intercontinental title, I don't know. The guy deserves a shot. I would hate it if I came online one day and I saw that WWE let him go. It's possible that they will cut him at some point. I think it would be a mistake without trying to do something with him first. Now, these are all Raw to SmackDown moves that I've mentioned, and obviously there's got to be some guys from SmackDown that go over to Raw. My list is only really, well, technically it's four people, but three acts. I jotted down the names of three different SmackDown acts that can move over to Raw. Big Show. And really, it's a toss-up with Big Show and Kane. I don't know that you need both guys on that show. Now, obviously, they're the tag team champions. So, you know, I first jotted this down before I heard that they won the belts. So that probably goes out the window. I guess where Big Show goes, Kane goes. But I don't know that they need to be kept together. And you can keep one guy on SmackDown and move the other one over to Raw. They're interchangeable as far as I'm concerned. Big Show and Kane are these... They've been around a long time. And they've both gone back and forth from heel to face, heel to face, heel to face. You know, one, you know, they're being pushed as a monster 1 minute, and then the next minute they're straddling Santino's trombone. I mean, they've gone back and forth so many times with these guys. They could almost be used like a utility role. You can use them in any way that you need to. But Big Show does not need to be on the same show as Kane when they're not tag team champions, that is. And Big Show has been floundering now on SmackDown. He's been feuding with the core now for what seems like months. They don't do anything with him. He can be an entertaining guy. And if you're going to move all these people to SmackDown, you've got to find somebody to move to Raw. Big Show is just kind of the name that came to me as making sense. You're not going to move Rey Mysterio over to Raw. You're not going to move Christian over to Raw, so why not move Big Show? Drew McIntyre, he's a guy that, again, was getting this big push. He was the chosen one. Remember, he was Vince McMahon's future prodigy, and they were pushing him for a while, and he was the Intercontinental Champion, and then his push stopped. And you can argue that it was because his wife has a big mouth. His wife, of course, used to be Tiffany, the ECW general manager. She got fired. She had a lot of things to say about the company. that were not so positive. Perhaps that reflected back onto Drew, and he got punished for it. Some people have said that Drew has a bit of an ego backstage that rubbed people the wrong way. The truth probably lies somewhere in the middle. It could be a combination of those things. But McIntyre is a guy that his career has stalled. They don't do anything with him. And I think there's something there. Like, he's got a good look to him. He's a big, tall guy. And I just think back to the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view in February. He was in that awesome SmackDown match. He came out of his pod in the Elimination Chamber match, and he just ran roughshod over everybody. He was kicking everybody's ass. He threw Rey Mysterio like a lawn dart into the plexiglass. People at one point were chanting his name. So he's a guy who, again, you could do something with him. Here's a guy that could get over if you give him a chance. But on SmackDown, I think his days are done. What's left for him to do on that show? Move him over to Raw. He'll be a fresh face on the show. And let him sink or swim. We'll see if he gets over with the crowd. The other act that I would probably move over would be Lay Cool, just because there always is at least one diva transaction of some kind. And, Lay Cool's been a hot act on SmackDown for a while. Now they're having, these skits where they're in couples therapy and they're teasing breaking them up. If they're not going to break them up, I say ship them over to Raw. God knows they showed up on Raw so many times anyway before WrestleMania. They almost feel like a Raw act anyway. But I could go either way with this. Again, when it comes to the Divas, they don't really do a whole hell of a lot with them. They don't do enough to make them feel important. So it really doesn't matter what show they're on. But that's my SmackDown picks. That's who I would move over from SmackDown to Raw. More people, I think, should go from Mondays to Fridays because SmackDown, their roster is very thin right now, and they need a lot of help, and those are the moves I would make. Whatever moves you guys would make, let me know. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that. You can email me or post on Facebook. Let me know what you think. Tough Enough from this past week. And by the way, the last episode of Tough Enough from this week pulled in a 1.5 rating, which is its lowest number yet, and not good. Still better than TNA Impact, but not a good number. Which is a shame because, again, I am thoroughly enjoying Tough Enough. This week we had two people leave the show. Jennifer, the wife of Johnny Fairplay, who might be a name that you remember. Johnny Fairplay was he was on the reality show Survivor many years ago, and big wrestling fan. He's been in TNA. I don't think he's ever been in WWE, but he's definitely done stuff with TNA. And Jennifer is his wife. She quit. She could not bear to be apart from her baby girl anymore. She had this great speech, this heartfelt, emotional promo, tears streaming down her face. Even Steve Austin gave her a lot of props and asked her for a hug. And it was all good. It was made to be a feel-good story. You know, she wanted to do this, but she wanted to be with her daughter more. And that's what she did. She quit. So she eliminated herself, essentially. And then at the end of the show, we had Michael get eliminated. It came down to him and Ryan, the guy with the blonde ponytail, in a promo challenge. They had to cut promos on each other, and whoever cut the better promo was going to be able to stay. And they had to do this promo in the ring in front of Steve Austin. And I will give Ryan his props. He cut a very good promo. He cut a hell of a lot better promo than Michael did. And it was obvious that Michael was pretty much going to be out of there, and he was. He got cut. We had cameos on the show from Big Show and Stacey Keibler. Stacey Keibler's cameo, by the way, was completely pointless. It was the first time we've seen her on TV doing anything even remotely related to WWE in years since she left the company. And keep in mind that it's Shed Media is the company promoting and producing this show. So just because Stacey Keibler was on Tough Enough does not mean that she had to go through WWE or that she in any way negotiated with WWE. It was probably Shed Media and the people producing the show that went to her. So there still has been no real communication or negotiations of any kind that I'm aware of between her and WWE in all the time that she's been gone, which is interesting. Big Show came on. He didn't really do much either. He kind of just observed them taking bumps. He did take Eric, the big dude with the afro, aside at one point to give him some advice from one big guy to another. So that was nice of him. Next week, by the way, Bret Hart will be on the show. The other thing about this episode, Steve Austin took some bumps. He took some flat back bumps in the middle of the ring. And he wrestled Luke one of the people from the cast. He's probably the favorite right now to win the whole thing. Austin took Luke and basically wrestled the match for all intents and purposes in the middle of the ring. And that may have been the closest thing that we will ever get to a Steve Austin match. So if you did not see this episode of Tough Enough and you were hoping that one day you would see Steve Austin back in the ring, don't know if that's ever going to happen or not, but if it doesn't, this is the closest thing you're ever going to get to it. So seek out this episode. It was actually a lot of fun to watch. And Austin, for a guy who is in his, his mid to late 40s and all the abuse that his body took and he had to retire all those years ago, it was a small glimpse, but Austin looked pretty damn good in that ring. And like I said, it was fun to watch. It was a good episode. We'll see Bret Hart on there next week. I'm sure Bret Hart and Steve Austin will share some stories, and should be a good time. And that leads to Raw. Now, Raw this week was taped from the UK. I'm not a big fan of these UK Raw shows. Nothing against the UK. It's just, I don't know, it's just weird to me when I watch these shows. It just has a different feel to it. But in any event, Raw started in a very auspicious way. We had R-Truth come out. Now, R-Truth, of course, ended Raw the week before with John Cena as the number one contender to the WWE Championship. And it was going to be John Cena, R-Truth, and The Miz in a triple threat match at Extreme Rules. R-Truth would get his very first championship opportunity. And if nothing else, the best thing I could say about that was it was certainly going to be different. It was certainly going to be a new face, at least in the main event, if nothing else. R-Truth comes out. He cuts a promo. John Morrison interrupts him. He comes out. So we're starting an episode of Raw with John Morrison and R-Truth cutting a promo back and forth in the middle of the ring. This already feels like a very different show. But you know what? At least it's not John Cena. So I think to myself, let's give this a shot. Let's see how they do. And the best thing that I could say about this opening promo, which was not good, is that even still, I felt that R-Truth did a much better job than John Morrison did. This whole thing was painful to watch, but I still think R-Truth did better than Morrison. And I know the Morrison fans are going to just ream me for that, but he's just not a good promo guy. I'm sorry. R-Truth was better than he was here. And that's not saying much, because I'm not saying R-Truth was fantastic. This led to a match where R-Truth, being the bright, smart, intelligent person that he is, decided that he would agree to a match where he put his title shot at Extreme Rules on the line against John Morrison, the same title shot that he worked so hard for in that gauntlet match the week before, the same title shot that he himself said he had never, ever gotten his entire career. And he certainly wasn't handed a title shot. He worked very hard for it last week. So what does he do? He agrees to put the title shot up for grabs in a match against John Morrison. So naturally, what ends up happening? R-Truth, being the idiot that he is, loses. Gets pinned with the Starship Pain 1-2-3, and so ends the week-long reign, I guess we will say, of R-Truth as a number one contender to the WWE Championship. John Morrison steals his spot, and he will be in what is now being billed as a triple threat cage match, because I guess it's Extreme Rules and every match has to have a stipulation. So this is going to be a steel cage match, and R-Truth is on the outside looking in. Now, the post-match angle to this match has caused a lot of controversy this week, but I have to say, I really, really enjoyed this a lot. It was the only saving grace of the opening half hour of this show. The promo sucked, the match was okay. R-Truth looked like a complete moron, losing his title shot, putting it on the line even in the first place. But the way they handled his heel turn post-match, I thought, was just really well done. It's a sort of heel turn you don't see too often these days. It was not a swerve for the sake of a swerve. It was not a heel turn that didn't make sense. It made perfect sense. R-Truth realized he was an idiot. He realized he had lost the only thing that really meant a damn thing to him, and he snapped. And as John Morrison was posing on the ropes, he yanked him off the ropes, started kicking his ass, kicked him out of the ring. And at various points, he started to show some remorse. He started to feel a little bit badly for what he was doing, and he would go help Morrison up. Again, Morrison's been a good friend of his for a while. They used to be tag team partners. And as soon as he would help him up, he would knock him right back down again. And, earlier when they did their back and forth promo, one of the things that Morrison was insulting him about, he was insulting R-Truth for being out of shape, which is comical, of course, because he had a couple of sips of water. They had footage of him in between the matches last week during the gauntlet. He was sneaking in a few sips from a water bottle. So somehow, this equates to him being out of shape. And the other thing he criticized him for was smoking cigarettes, which I think Truth might actually do in real life. I'm not sure if it's a play off that or not, but I know Randy Orton used to smoke. But what ended up happening here has caused a great deal of controversy. And what happened is R-Truth, as Morrison is laid out on the outside, he goes up to one of the people in the crowd who gives him a pack of cigarettes. And R-Truth proceeds to light up one of the cigarettes and begins smoking. And he goes over to John Morrison, he kneels over his body, he starts blowing cigarette smoke all over him, like a true heel. Now, of course, the fans start chanting, "That's illegal," during this whole segment, because apparently it is illegal to smoke in an indoor venue in the UK. By the way, it's also illegal in this country, it's not just a UK thing. For the people who wrote in to me, who may have been at the show, I guess it was edited off of UK television. This aired in full on USA Network. So here in the States, we saw the whole thing. It was not edited here in this country. And so anyway, they're chanting it's illegal, which is not exactly true. Apparently there's an exemption if it's part of a play or a performance of some kind, which this was. So it, in fact, was not illegal. And this sent certain people into a frenzy. I chuckled when one of the fans in the front row was audibly noticeable when they said this. One of the fans was like, "What about the children? Think of the children." And I took that to be a joke. I thought it was said in a joking way, and the person probably laughed it off. I laughed at it. And apparently not everybody was laughing, because there was an anti-smoking activist who spoke to TMZ.com. His name is Patrick Reynolds. He's the executive director of TobaccoFree.org, and he is demanding a public apology from R-Truth for smoking in front of children. He told TMZ, "For R-Truth to smoke in front of children is irresponsible. At best, it's thoughtless, and at worst, if he calculated appealing to kids by posing as a bad boy outlaw, it is evil." WWE responded to this, by the way, by saying the negative effect of smoking that it has on one's health and physical performance was part of a storyline on Raw this week. Negative depictions of tobacco use on television are not unusual and can be seen on other TV PG shows. Listen, there are a lot of things that you can knock WWE for, okay? Its treatment of women. It used to have a horrendous record for its treatment of women on TV. And even now, it's not like they treat women like royalty, but once upon a time, women were getting beaten up and taking body slams every week. Trish Stratus had to bark like a dog for Vince McMahon. There's a lot of shit that you can point to, okay, that people can be up in arms about. And racial stereotypes and language that they would use for, you know, homosexuals. Okay, we just talked about that recently, in fact. John Cena got taken to task by GLAAD for that very same thing in that promo he cut on The Rock back in February. This is not an example of something that I would take WWE to task for. And in fact, I applaud WWE. I'm going to take the exact opposite approach and tell Patrick Reynolds to just stick it up his ass, because to me, this is an example of taking political correctness too far. R-Truth in this segment is clearly being depicted as a bad guy. I don't care if people are cheering him, and people will always cheer for the bad guys, okay? His depiction in this angle was that of a bad guy. He had just turned on his best friend. He beat the shit out of him. Now he's smoking a cigarette. He's blowing it on him. It's a heel act. WWE is absolutely right. This is not a situation where they're trying to paint R-Truth as a bad boy outlaw. Okay? I don't think that was the goal of this segment. And here's a guy who I doubt he even watches WWE. Who even knows if he watched the segment? I mean, there were probably people who got their feathers ruffled. He found out about it and decided, you know what? I'm gonna try to get my name in the news, and I want an apology. I want an apology from R-Truth. So what I hope happens is this. R-Truth, apparently being a bad boy outlaw, according to Patrick Reynolds, I would love for R-Truth to cut an in-character promo on him on television next week and just tear him a new asshole. And end the segment by blowing cigarette smoke right into the camera lens. That's how I would love to see that. That would be absolutely phenomenal. It would be my favorite part of Raw this week if they had the guts to actually do that. And I'm sure they won't. It probably will be the very last time, quite frankly, that we see smoking on TV. I'm not saying we should see it every week. It should not become a regular part of his character. When WCW... I'll give you a great example, actually. This guy is talking about their depiction of him as being a bad boy outlaw. WCW did this in the late 90s. You may remember a period of time when they had the Giant, the Big Show, come out smoking a cigarette because he in fact, used to smoke quite a bit. And they incorporated it into his character. Now, at the time, I'm pretty sure he was still with the NWO. Could be wrong about that. And even if he wasn't, all of the heels in WCW, all the top heels, especially if you were in the NWO at any point in time, those guys were absolutely, absolutely cool heels. They were supposed to be the cool outlaw type guys, okay? These were not guys that were going out there trying to be traditional wrestling heels, getting booed out of the building, okay? These were guys like Kevin Nash and Scott Hall who would go out there, and they loved getting that mixed reaction from the crowd. They loved getting the cheers. They could pretend to be the bad boy heel, but they could go out there and get cheered like the biggest fucking baby face in the entire world, okay? That's what WCW was at that time. So when the Giant would come out smoking a cigarette on his way to the ring, he absolutely was playing it as the cool outlaw type character, okay? Where was Patrick Reynolds back then, okay? I don't remember hearing too many people getting up in arms about that. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe WCW got in a lot of trouble for it. I just don't remember there being such an uproar. But the world is a different place now. You've got TMZ, you've got all these different outlets. People are going to find something to complain about no matter what. Is WWE not supposed to ever try something out of the box? Are they just supposed to be... I mean, again, they get criticized a lot for being too predictable. And sometimes it's okay to be predictable. But every now and then, you got to break out of the box and try something different. When I saw R-Truth light up that cigarette on Raw, the first thing I thought of, besides the Giant doing it in WCW, was, this feels different to me. I'm happy to see WWE actually taking a risk. And I knew that somebody was going to have a problem with this. And I didn't care. I liked it. As long as it's not every single week, I liked it. So Patrick Reynolds and all the anti-smoking advocates need to not get their undies in a bunch every time someone lights up a smoke on television, okay? R-Truth is not out there trying to get little kids to smoke cigarettes. I assure you that was not the goal. That was not the intention of this segment. If Patrick Reynolds is so concerned about youth smoking, take my word for it, okay? I've been out of college now for many years. But if he wants to really make a difference, if he wants to focus his efforts where potentially he could really, truly make a difference, take your ass to any college campus in America, okay? And you will see a smoking epidemic, the likes of which you have never seen before. It seems like smoking has actually gone up. It has not gone down, okay? Don't worry about Raw, which you probably don't even watch in the first place. Take your ass to any college campus in America and work your magic there. Try to convince those kids to stop smoking. I swear, when I was on campus, I would walk, and I could not go 10 feet without having somebody blow cigarette smoke back in my face. And it would piss the fucking shit out of me so much. You literally could not take a step without having somebody blow cigarette smoke in your face. It was unbelievable to me. Okay, why don't you worry about that? Worry about that a little bit more. Don't worry so much about wrestling. Some other notes here from Raw that I took down while watching the show. Dolph Ziggler has a new haircut. He now has short, cropped brown hair instead of long, well, kind of semi-long blonde hair. So basically, he now looks like every other guy on the roster. He looked like a Ted DiBiase clone, in all honesty, when he walked out there. He still got a good look to him, but he looks like every other person on the WWE roster. Sin Cara teamed up with John Cena, had a pretty good match against Alex Riley and The Miz. I enjoyed that. Eve and Nikki Bella, on the flip side, had a god-awful match. There were so many botched spots, I felt sorry for them, to be honest with you. There was one spot in the match where I think Nikki was supposed to grab Eve's leg. Eve, the egg, was hanging off the ring apron, and Nikki was going to lift up Eve's leg and just kind of drape it over the apron. And I don't know what went wrong, but she basically let go, and Eve had to kind of smash her own leg over the apron. That's just one example of many botched spots in this match. Botched enough where I try not to watch these matches like I'm watching a match to see how many spots are botched. That's not a way to watch a wrestling show, okay? You're not going to enjoy watching wrestling if that's how you're going to analyze every match. I get that. I try not to do that. This was a match where it was impossible not to notice it. It was just a really bad match. Speaking of bad, the Michael Cole segment was fucking stupid. Once again, Vince McMahon must embarrass Jim Ross. Jim Ross is forced to kiss Michael Cole's apparently athlete's foot, ridden foot. That's what he called it, athlete's foot. It was quite a bit of makeup. They made his foot look quite gross, I must admit. We had musical chairs this week, yet again with the announcers. We had Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler calling the first half of the show. Then Cole and Matthews took over after that segment. Just make up your mind who you want to announce the goddamn show, please. We had another promo for Awesome Kong's impending arrival in WWE. Again, really good stuff. Apparently, her name may be Karma. Karma with an H. But now I'm hearing that that's not, that possibly is not going to be her name. So I'm not sure what's going on. Karma may or may not be her name when she ultimately makes her debut. It's not 100% confirmed. So anybody who says that it's confirmed doesn't know what they're talking about. Randy Orton, CM Punk, they had a fine main event. Nothing wrong with it. I see a lot of people heaping praise on it. It was a really, really good match. Not really. I thought it was good. It wasn't really anything special. I thought their WrestleMania match was probably better. Orton wins clean yet again with a roll-up. I hope that this thing wraps up at Extreme Rules because this feud, to me, has run its course. Like I said, they're going to have a last-man-standing match at the pay-per-view. Next week, this week, let's talk about this week first. Again, the draft is coming up this week. The week after that, May 2nd, The Rock will be celebrating his 39th birthday. It's the Rock Raw coming up that week. And apparently Jonathan Coachman has teased, he has a new Twitter account. He has been teasing that perhaps he may stop by to celebrate The Rock's birthday with him. So hopefully, I think that would be really cool, actually, if the coach stopped by. Haven't seen him in a while since he made the jump over to ESPN. So hopefully, hopefully they've got some fun stuff lined up. I know Mick Foley was actually campaigning on Twitter saying that perhaps he could get Dixie Carter and TNA to allow him to appear on Raw. I had a hearty laugh at that. If Foley actually thinks that's going to happen, well, I shouldn't say that. TNA actually is dumb enough. They might actually let Foley go. Some news and notes here from around the wrestling world. According to the Wrestling Observer, Joe Laurinaitis, Animal from the Road Warriors, has said that he's been asked to be part of the next season of NXT. I believe that would be NXT Season 6. He was told it would be 5 retired Hall of Famers coaching 5 newcomers, which, if that's true, is an interesting concept. I mean, certainly they reserve the right to change their minds. I know that this season of NXT that is currently ongoing, they had a completely different idea for it, and then at the last minute, I guess because they knew Tough Enough was debuting and would take whatever attention might be devoted to NXT away from that show, that changed their minds and the entire format of the show. But 5 retired Hall of Famers coaching newcomers is a concept I think I could get behind. Jeff Hardy legal update. His drug case received yet another continuance, surprise, surprise, this week. Ironically, this continuance came on Wednesday 4/20. So these jokes just write themselves. His defense attorney asked the judge, apparently, for additional time. Now, keep in mind, it's going to be 2 years before this case gets settled, but he needs more time for Hardy to be assessed for whether he needs drug rehab. Next hearing set for June 27th. Abyss, according to Pro Wrestling Insider, was injured at the TNA tapings this week. He underwent dental surgery on Thursday to repair his upper lip and have 4 to 5 teeth pulled. That sucks. Apparently, the teeth were badly damaged during an errant springboard kick from Rob Van Dam at the Impact tapings on Monday. You know, every time RVD talks about how big of a star he is or how he's better than everyone else, let's all remember stuff like this because, you know, it's a tough business, injuries happen and all that jazz, but aside from maybe Ahmed Johnson in the WWF, I don't think I've ever heard as many stories of wrestlers getting hurt or stiffed in the ring as I have when it comes to RVD matches. If he was such a great worker, you'd think he'd do a better job of protecting the people he's in the ring with, but What do I know? Jay Lethal, gone from TNA. It's already off their roster page. He worked the Lockdown pay-per-view last weekend and had been with TNA since 2005. Of course, everyone would remember his Black Machismo character where he did a dead-on imitation of Randy Savage. It was very entertaining. And, of course, nobody does a better Ric Flair impersonation than Jay Lethal. Even Ric Flair himself, when he first saw Lethal do his impersonation, loved the guy. I mean, he absolutely loved it. And, you know, Lethal's a very entertaining guy, a talented guy. I first saw him, my first exposure to him was in Ring of Honor many years ago. And no word yet on whether or not this was something that Lethal asked for, but by all accounts, it was not. And it was a decision that TNA made. They got rid of him, and there you have it. So he's out accepting indie bookings. And, you know, I'd say that I would love to see him in WWE, but to be honest, what would they really do with him? I mean, if he ends up in WWE, great. I hope the best for him, but it's not like he's going to go there and they're going to do anything with him. So, I don't know. Hopefully he'll, I'm sure he'll find indie work very easily. And a quick Desmond Wolfe update for the person who emailed me. The only thing I know about the Desmond Wolfe situation is that Desmond Wolfe is of the impression that he will be back at any time. He has been ready for a while. He's been ready to come back. At one point, he had been back at the tapings, and they had filmed some vignettes for him to hype a comeback that were supposed to air on TV. And then at the last minute, TNA nixed them and never aired them. TNA is of the impression that he will not be back for a long time, if ever. And perhaps may offer him an agent position at some point. So, on one side, he thinks he's ready to come back. On the other side, apparently, I guess they feel differently. And perhaps perhaps Desmond Wolfe may never be back in a TNA ring. So, basically, nobody seems to know what the hell's going on with Desmond Wolfe. We don't know if it's a physical issue, some, you know, some sort of medical issue that came up. I honestly don't know. I don't know. There's been no explanation of it. They don't acknowledge it on TV. TNA does not acknowledge it on their website or anywhere else. And I guess if I hear anything new, I'll mention it here on the podcast. Lastly here, keep Scott Hall in your prayers. He apparently is not in a good place right now. And Kevin Nash posted a very emotional blog entry on his Tumblr blog this past week. Pretty extensive entry. It's worth going out of your way to read. Basically sticking up for his buddy and, you know, talking about the problems that he's had. And I think at one point in the blog, he almost compared it to how soldiers on the battlefield go through these you know, situations where they lose a lot of their friends. They lose a lot of their compatriots in the field of battle, and he was kind of comparing that to what wrestlers go through. I'm not sure that was the best comparison to make, although I see the point that he's trying to make, in that a lot of wrestlers lose a lot of friends because wrestlers do stupid things, and unfortunately they die young, and Nash certainly does not want to see his best friend meet the same fate, and he's doing everything in his power, but at the same time, Scott Hall is, you know, he's a grown man, and Kevin Nash is not his, he's not his dad. You know, he can only watch him so much. Nash did post on Twitter that he had seen Scott in the hospital, where I guess he is still in the hospital, and he said that he was smiling and in good spirits, but had lost a ton of weight. So obviously, he's going through a litany of different issues, not good right now, but hopefully he'll pull through because, you know, he's a talented guy, and I think somewhere, you know, deep in there, he's a good guy who's just very troubled and has a lot of problems and is probably a little fucked up in the head, and hopefully he can turn it around, because nobody wants to read the story about Scott Hall meeting his demise. Nobody wants to read a Scott Hall obituary for many, many more years, so best of luck to him. Mailbag time. Let's get to your questions here. First one comes from Alex from Tijuana, Mexico. Dear Solomonster, just got done with Sound Off 155. Great show, as always. I was wondering, this show is just over 2 hours, and sometimes you usually say that it is a labor of love. How much time does it take you to make a two-hour show from the moment you sit down and get to work on it, record it, edit it, and post it? I figure it's around the 3 to 4 hour range. Thank you, as always. Keep up the good work. I'd say that's pretty accurate. Sometimes it'll take a little longer, a little less, but probably a little over 4 hours from start to finish. You know, even if it's like a 90-minute show, If there's any editing that has to be done, if I have to put the intro together, if there is an intro, which there is most of the time. The conversion, if it's a longer show, it takes a little bit longer. I have to label it. You know, the posting of it, and hopefully Podbean is working. Sometimes it's not. And then putting it on Twitter, on Facebook, on SC Scoops. There's a lot that goes into it, I think, that some people don't realize. So I'd say it's about a four-hour operation from start to finish. David from Silver Spring, Maryland, writes in, there are talented wrestlers that either had a brief stay in WWE or never made the cut. One that comes to mind is Jerry Lynn. This hardcore Hall of Famer had great 10 years in WCW, TNA, and ROH. He's won at least one title in every promotion, including WWE. Unfortunately, Jerry was in there for about a year. I'm glad he continues to find work on the indies, but why hasn't he had a longer stay in WWE? I think he would have been more successful than Jeff Hardy. I wouldn't go that far. Jerry Lynn is a very good wrestler. And anybody that remembers the old ECW will remember some classic battles with him and Rob Van Dam. They had some great matches. And in fact, when TNA did their Hardcore Justice pay-per-view, they wanted RVD versus Jerry Lynn as the main event. That was the match that was booked, and it was going to happen, and then Jerry Lynn got injured while he was training and preparing for the match. And it turned into a match instead between RVD and Sabu, which was good, but nowhere near, I think, what Jerry Lynn and RVD would have been. He was a light heavyweight champion, as you mentioned, in WWE, so he had some level of success. The problem with Jerry Lynn, he was too vanilla for WWE. And when you say that he could have been more successful than Jeff Hardy, as a wrestler, he was probably much better than Jeff Hardy. But as a character, as somebody that would, you know, again, sell tickets, sell merchandise, all the things that are important to WWE, cut a promo, which was never Jeff Hardy's greatest suit himself. He was never a tremendous promo guy, although he's gotten better over time. And Jerry Lynn isn't no slouch himself. But Jerry Lynn, when you say the name and you look at the guy, in all due respect, he doesn't exactly light your world on fire. That's what WWE is looking for. And to insinuate that he could have been more successful in that company than Jeff Hardy was, I don't know that you and I are thinking of the same company here. So I wouldn't go that far. But yeah, it's a shame he didn't have a longer run. He could have been bigger than he was, but make no mistake about it, he only would have reached a certain level. There's no way that I could ever see Jerry Lynn ascending to the point, for example, of being a world heavyweight champion in WWE. He never, ever would have gotten that opportunity. Joe from Trenton writes in, you mentioned that Steve Austin saying that if he wanted to come back and wrestle, he could. If he were to come back, could you see him wrestling CM Punk? How would you play the storyline between them to make it a must-see match, even though I know it would be must-see no matter what? Been listening since an episode in the 40s, also a triple fan of SC Scoops. Thanks and keep up the good work. I would keep this very simple. There's no reason to overbook it. In my opinion, if Austin was going to come back and work against a newer guy or a younger guy and not a guy like an Undertaker or a Rock or a Triple H, CM Punk would be probably the number one guy I would go for. And I've been saying that for a long time. You can go back and listen. I think the first time I ever made mention of that match was episode 26 of the Sound Off. So I've been thinking for a long time that this would be a good match. And obviously, it's a ready-made match because you have CM Punk, who loves to talk about his straight-edge lifestyle. He led a faction, for crying out loud, called the Straight Edge Society. He doesn't drink. He doesn't do drugs. Austin, on the other hand, not to say that Austin does drugs, Austin obviously is a big beer drinker. Drinks beer, flips people off. He's a very gritty, very down and in-your-face kind of guy. Tells it like it is. CM Punk feels he tells it like it is, but he would not approve of the lifestyle that Steve Austin lives. And there's your built-in storyline right now. And the way I would work it is, Austin and Punk in recent weeks, Punk has actually been silent on Twitter for like 2 weeks now. I guess he's trying to give it up, but you know he's going to be back at some point. But before he took his Twitter leave of absence, him and Austin were kind of needling each other back and forth. I'm sure all in good fun. And everybody saw this, and all of a sudden people thought, "Whoa, this is going to lead to a match." You know, Austin hates Punk, and Punk hates Austin. And you could certainly play it that way. If Austin were to agree to a match and came back, you don't have to acknowledge that they had a Twitter war. I think that you don't have to, you know, people on TV are not going to give a shit that they were insulting each other on Twitter. But basically, you can have Austin in the ring for whatever reason on a given episode of Raw. He gets interrupted by Punk. Punk comes out with a microphone, and it just takes off from there. Again, Punk could talk about how he used to watch Steve Austin matches when he was a young wrestler coming up in the business, and he used to respect him, but you know, he has no respect for Austin's lifestyle. He's a 40-year-old or 45-year-old man who still drinks beer and this and that. And Austin, of course, can have his own retort, very bothered the fact that Punk would come out and disrespect him like that. And this could go on for a couple of weeks. You know, Austin doesn't have to be on the show each week, but each week Punk comes out and he has a different insult for Steve Austin. He has something new to say each week about Stone Cold, trying to coax him into a match. And it doesn't work at first. This goes on for many weeks. Eventually, it leads to Austin coming back, accepting Punk's challenge, and they have a match on pay-per-view. And originally, I was going to say, being that Punk is the leader of the... Well, I won't call them the New Nexus, since they're not really new anymore. But as part of the Nexus, Punk can even have each of his Nexus members go after Austin. Not that Austin would wrestle against them necessarily, but if Austin were to show up on TV, Punk can certainly send each one of his Nexus guys after Austin, and Austin can beat them up. But being that they already did this with Randy Orton, it would kind of seem like rehashing the same thing over again. So you don't even have to do that. I think Punk and Austin by themselves could carry themselves very well on the mic. Punk is very good on the microphone, and he's very good, I think, at putting over whatever feud he may be in. Not everybody has that ability, but Punk's a special guy. And Austin, we already know that Austin is awesome on the microphone. I mean, he is truly one of the only must-see parts of Tough Enough. And I like Tough Enough as a show, but Austin just blows everybody else out of the water. And anybody who thinks that Austin doesn't have it anymore, he's gone soft, he's older now, he's not what he used to be, needs to watch Steve Austin on that show. Austin can go out there and cut a promo as good, if not better, than anybody else. And by the time these two guys are done yakking after all those weeks of build-up, people would pay big money to see them go one-on-one in a pay-per-view match, especially because Austin has not had a match in almost a decade. So I think if Austin did want to come back at some point and do one more match, there is no better opponent for him than CM Punk. Got a letter here from Seth, who's a big fan of the podcast. Him and his father, apparently, have been loving the show since both of them discovered it. That's kind of cool, see? The Sound Off brings people together, including family members. A father and his son can enjoy the show. I think that's fantastic. Anyway, Seth is turning 21 on Easter Sunday, and would love it if I could possibly find the time to give him a shout-out here on the Sound Off. It would make for a great gift when he gets home from Vegas. Well, here's your gift, Seth. Happy birthday. Hopefully you have a good time in Vegas. You know, Vegas is one of those places. I feel like I'm the only person in this country who has not been to Vegas. I've been to Atlantic City, but let's be honest. Atlantic City can be nice, but it ain't no Vegas. It's more like a poor man's Vegas. So I got to make my way out there one of these days. And actually, if I ever do, it would be quite wild, I think, if I could record a Sound Off live from Vegas. That would be fun. I know you guys would love to listen to that. So if you want to finance my trip, the quicker I get out to Vegas, the quicker I can do a live show from there. So I, any gifts or contribution to the Solo Monster Vegas Fund are quite welcome. Jim writes in. Some of you may know him as Voorhees666 on SC Scoops. Has a few things to say here about this whole anti-smoking hoopla stemming from Raw last Monday. By now, the WWE has gotten two complaints in as many months between the gay community and now this anti-tobacco group. Being a WWE fan for a while now, I'm starting to get tired of all these groups getting ready to riot every time the company does something offensive. I can understand WWE is now a family-friendly company, and many of the superstars are idols to many people, mostly kids. By the way, I just have to say something about that. I may have mentioned this before, but it's a total misconception that kids make up most of the WWE audience. Kids are an important part of WWE's audience, and they certainly like to publicly say that they, you know, they're more family-friendly. They market a lot of their stuff towards kids. The reality is there are actually fewer kids watching WWE now than there were 12 years ago during the Attitude Era. There's actually more adults watching the product now. There were more kids staying up late to watch Raw and all of the raunchy stuff in the late 90s than there are now. So that's just a little misconception there. But anyway, Jim says that he can understand WWE tries hard to make sure that it doesn't intentionally offend anybody, but after the whole R-Truth thing on Raw, I'm getting quite tired of all these protest groups. Where one of these groups going to draw the line? Makes a few other points here. He says, maybe I'm looking into this too much, but it just seems to irk me. At least we can give these anti-tobacco people credit for causing an uproar about the incident and not waiting almost a month, like GLAD did. Well, first of all, that's a good point, except that I don't give the anti-tobacco people any credit at all. And by the way, really we're talking about one person. I guess he's speaking out on behalf of his organization, but we're talking about that one individual who made those comments and requested an apology. And I am not going to give them any credit at all. You're willing to give them credit and say, at least they didn't wait a month. But again, I saw nothing wrong with what happened on Raw Monday night. I absolutely saw nothing wrong. If John Cena came to the ring on Monday night, smiling like he always does with a cigarette in his hand, then you'd have a case. That would be bad. That would be very bad. But I see absolutely nothing wrong with what happened on Monday. As long as it doesn't become a regular occurrence and a regular part of the character, I give them credit for nothing. They got their panties in a bunch for no reason whatsoever. They're not going to get an apology from R-Truth. I don't think they should ever get an apology from R-Truth. You're not going to be able to please everybody all the time. And if I'm WWE, I'm not sweating this at all. In fact, I'm ignoring it. And I'm moving on. At some point, you have to draw the line. I think this is where I would draw that line. Rob writes in, dear Solemn Monster, after seeing some old WWF matches on YouTube, I've begun to wonder whatever happened to those old spots in matches where a wrestler would get his opponent's arms tied up in the ropes. It seemed like a popular maneuver to do at the time in order to get a wrestler immobilized, as it were. Jake Roberts, Randy Savage in the Snake Bite, for example. Andre the Giant used to get tied up in the ropes a lot. But it seems like that type of spot just is not done anymore, with wrestlers instead choosing to handcuff their opponent to the ring ropes if they want to keep them stationary. A buddy of mine suggested that it's because the type of ropes WWE uses today are not the same, or that they are not as elastic as the ones that were used in the 80s and the early 90s, and therefore it is harder for the wrestlers to do that anymore. Is there any truth to this, and can you recall the last time you saw a wrestler in WWE actually get his arms caught in the ropes? I cannot, actually, in recent years, remember a wrestler getting his arms caught in the ropes, or... there have been instances where it happened by accident if somebody was being, let's say, thrown out of the ring and they get their arm or their ankle tied up in the ropes. But as far as that spot that you're referring to, again, Andre the Giant used to do that a lot. When he was feuding with the Ultimate Warrior and Jake Roberts, again, by which point he was already immobile himself and couldn't do much in the ring, that's why he was doing that spot all the time. It was a great way to get heat from the crowd. I can't remember in modern times the last time that I saw that. And actually, I was going to use the example of Triple H and Randy Orton before their match at WrestleMania 25, when Orton gave Stephanie an RKO later out. Triple H was immobilized. When I first thought back, I could have sworn he was tied up in the ropes, and in fact, he was handcuffed. So that's not a good example to use. I don't remember. But as far as, are the ropes any different? I don't think the ropes are any different at all. I think the ropes are more or less the same kind of ropes they've always used. And I don't think they're any more or less elastic than they used to be. I mean, WWE ropes, for example, were always different than the ropes that WCW used. WCW used to use actual cable, which had a lot less give to it. And it's probably the reason that Mick Foley lost his ear when he was in that match with Vader in Munich back in 94. Had the ropes been more like WWF ropes at the time, I think Foley would probably have all of his ear still intact. But WWE ropes, I don't think they've changed at all over the years. I just think it's a spot that they just don't use it for whatever reason. Steve writes in, he's heard a few people get special birthday mentions worked into the podcast. His birthday was actually on the 22nd, so on Friday, he celebrated a birthday. Came on a sad note, though, as his dog of 10 years died on Wednesday of a heart attack. That sucks. Sorry to hear that. I have a pet, too, and you know, anytime a pet dies, it's a shitty thing. Hopefully your dog was not too young, but happy birthday. I don't know what else to say about the dog thing. That just really sucks, but hang in there, buddy. Hopefully you had a good birthday, and you can forget about all that soon enough. Daryl from Windsor, Ontario, Canada writes in, a listener since episode 1. His question has to do with the wrestling term X-Pac Heat. Why does it have that name? Was there an incident that happened to X-Pac to gain him that heat from the fans? Thanks for your insight. There was no one incident. Basically, at the later end of his WWE career, X-Pac wasn't nearly as over as he was when he first came in. And at this point, he was a heel. And basically, it got to the point where people would... They would almost groan when they would see him come out to the ring. It wasn't necessarily that he was boring, but people were just tired of seeing him. And the heat that he would get was not the traditional type of heat that you would want to get as a heel. And I think that really was the genesis of the term. So instead of getting the right form of heat, he got what people started referring to as X-Pac heat. I'll even say the same thing, quite frankly, about the Big Boss Man. God rest his soul, I love the Boss Man, but when he would come out in the second part of his WWE career, not the first time he was in the company, but in the late 90s, and his music would hit, his music was just god-awful, and as soon as people heard his music hit, it was like a universal groan throughout the crowd. Boss Man had X-Pac heat. I don't know if it was called X-Pac heat at that point. Maybe it's the other way around. Maybe X-Pac actually had Big Boss Man heat. I don't know. But basically, it's the sort of heat that you get that you don't want. If that helps, that's the best way I could possibly explain it. It's getting heat from the crowd, but it's not the type of heat that you want to get. It's not money-making heat. It's get-the-fuck-off-my-television heat. Rob writes in... Dear Solomonster, one quick thought on the name WrestleMania here before I get to my actual question. In light of the new rebranding by WWE, taking the word wrestling out of its name, and out of the vocabulary of the WWE universe, please don't say that, should they change the name of the marquee event? Sounds like a double standard to me if they don't. So basically he wants to know, will WWE take the word wrestling out of their WrestleMania name? Seems like the most appropriate thing to do. Look, you know what? I wouldn't put it past them to do anything. Do I think they're going to do it? No, of course not. But would it shock me? Nothing would shock me at this point. If you had told me a couple of years ago, if you would have told me 2 years ago that WWE was no longer going to be called World Wrestling Entertainment because they wanted to completely eliminate the word wrestling from its name, actually, you know what? In all honesty, I probably wouldn't have been shocked then either. I first started hearing rumors years ago that Vince McMahon was toying with the idea of getting rid of the ring. Okay? I don't know how far those considerations went before he finally came to his senses or somebody talked him out of it. If he was already thinking about that, nothing shocks me at this point. Should he take the word wrestling out of WrestleMania? Of course not. Of course not. I mean, that would be like changing the Super Bowl to something completely different. Why would you ever do that? The Super Bowl has been around for over 40 years. WrestleMania has been a staple in this company since 1985. It is the biggest event of the year, every single year. WrestleMania, the word WrestleMania, has become synonymous with their form of entertainment. For them to tamper with that at all would be suicide. Why they would want to do that, I don't know. So I don't expect that to happen. I don't think we have to worry about that. His actual question here is, would I not agree that while The Rock versus John Cena has the potential of being a big-time money match, wouldn't The Undertaker be a more suitable opponent for The Rock? Who would honestly be a bigger threat to the streak than The Rock? Seems like money lost to me, as this would be a bigger match than Rock-Cena. Unless Cena is the WWE or World Heavyweight Champion by the time WrestleMania 28 rolls around... Vince is altering his formula when it comes to only the WWE or World title match closes the show. Well, let me just finish the rest of his question here first. He says, since you've already said that while you love the Taker-Triple H match from WrestleMania 27, you would not want to see it again next year, Who would you rather see face Undertaker then? There's no one left worth a damn to be a credible threat to the streak. Maybe Kurt Angle comes back, maybe Brock Lesnar comes back, or Steve Austin. I cannot think of anyone else. I'm going to disagree with you on this, big time. Rock Undertaker is not a bigger match than Rock John Cena. First of all, The Rock is probably, now that I really stop and think about it, one of the few big-time wrestling names who never, ever had a problem putting somebody else over. Rock actually did the job for a lot of people. He made a lot of people look good. You know, he did the opposite of what a lot of top guys are known for doing. Chris Jericho is another example of a guy who, I still don't look at Jericho as being on the level of The Rock, and that's not a knock on Jericho. Very few people, if anybody, is quite on the level of The Rock and the level of star he was able to attain. But Jericho is another main event guy, former world champion, who probably loses more than he should, has never really had a problem putting other guys over, because I think he's been through it himself. You know, Rock went through it as well when he first came into WWF. He knows the game. He's been through it himself. So the idea that The Rock would be taken as a threat, the greatest threat ever to the Undertaker streak, I could easily see The Rock losing that match. It's not something where I go, well, you know, The Rock, here's a guy that, of course he's going to beat The Undertaker. No, I don't look at it that way. I look at it a little bit differently. If anything, again, John Cena, I think, would be a more credible threat than The Rock would be to The Undertaker streak, just because of the way John Cena's been booked throughout most of his WWE career. You know, John Cena has beaten everybody there is to beat. He's made people tap out, including Triple H himself. He's made Triple H submit in the main event of WrestleMania, for crying out loud. To me, you either have... There's two groups of people, okay? You either belong to one of these two groups. You are either of the opinion that I am not falling for this bullshit, and there is absolutely no way that Undertaker's streak is ever going to end, nor are you ever going to be able to convince me that his streak is at all in jeopardy, okay? Many people are part of that group. No match that The Undertaker could have, no opponent, no amount of stipulations will ever convince them that the streak is going to be broken. And then you have the other group of people who think, you know what? There may well be a chance that this streak could end. Perhaps that, you know, The Undertaker will put a young guy over, or they'll put him in a match with an established veteran like a John Cena, and there's no way Undertaker's going to be John Cena at WrestleMania. Or they'll fall for those little spots that they... Like Undertaker Triple H, for example. When Undertaker fell to the tombstone by Triple H, the seeds of doubt started creeping into my mind. You know, and in the minds of a lot of people as well. I am of the opinion, personally, the streak should not end. I am of the opinion the streak will not end. And if you were to sign a match, John Cena and The Rock, I'm sorry, John Cena and Undertaker, I just think that's the best way to go. But since that's not going to happen, who do you put in the ring with The Undertaker? Again, in a year, who's to say that Sting won't be available? And maybe you're not a fan of Sting. You know, Sting at that point is going to be 53. Obviously, physically, he's not what he used to be, but so what? You know, neither is The Undertaker. Sting is probably in far better physical shape than The Undertaker is at this point. It's still a dream match that a lot of people, I think, would pay money to see. And Sting has not ruled it out. Even Sting recently, he's done some interviews. He acknowledged that he had discussions recently with WWE before he decided to go back to TNA. He even made a comment in one of those interviews. He said, you know what, I'd be lying if I said it wouldn't be a cool thing to have one WrestleMania match. I still think it's a very good possibility that we could see that match as early as next year. But do I think that Rock vs. Undertaker is bigger than Cena and Rock? Absolutely not. Cena vs. Rock is the biggest, I would argue, is the biggest money match that WWE could do at this point. Austin Hogan, that ship has sailed. I mean, Hogan wrestling at all, to me, if he's even thinking about coming back, you know, in TNA later this year, he's just a complete fool. I mean, Hogan, if he had a back surgery that worked and he's having a pretty decent quality of life, why the fuck would you want to possibly even risk that? Why Hogan would want to risk coming back to the ring at this point, I don't know. But the ship has sailed on Austin Hogan. That would have been the biggest money match. To me, Rock vs. Cena is where it's at. Rock vs. Undertaker, eh. It would be an attraction, but it's not a bigger attraction to me than Rock vs. Cena. Sky writes in, as mentioned in this week's Wrestling Observer newsletter, what do you think about 3 out of the 12 boards of director members and the CEO resigning from WWE in the past 6 months. Is this a sign that WWE is starting to move in a direction that these people do not agree with? Or is it because Vince McMahon is harder to deal with than ever, his irrational behavior, constant changing of his mind? Secondly, if this continues, is it good or bad for WWE in the future? There have been a couple of members of the board of directors that have resigned. The most recent one, I believe, was actually a former governor. I believe he may have been a governor for the state of Connecticut. They claim, at least the most recent person who left, claimed that it actually had nothing to do with any new direction that WWE was taking. But I don't know. You start to see a couple of people leave. Donna Goldsmith, who was a very big part of their company, also left recently. I have a feeling that this new direction they're going in probably has more to do with it than they would admit. And that new direction, of course, being that WWE is looking to be more than just a wrestling company, because wrestling is a dirty word to them. And they're looking into buying different entertainment properties. I mean, they're actually willing, ready, and able to take on debt. You know, they're pretty much a debt-free company right now. They have a lot of cash on hand. They're very healthy. They're very profitable. And they will be for many more years to come under the existing model. All of a sudden, you change that business model, and you get outside of what you're good at, which is pro wrestling. You're opening up a Pandora's box that you may not be able to close. You're going to willingly put yourself into debt. You're going to perhaps buy up all these entertainment properties, and they may all flop. And if it starts to eat away at your core business, where does that leave WWE in the future? All of a sudden, this company that was so stable, and nobody was ever worried that this company is going to go out of business because they, you know, they do wrestling better than anybody else in this country, and they've got a lot of different revenue streams, and they're going to be just fine. And all of a sudden, you fuck with that model, and you start to change it, and you start to get into other areas that you're not so good at. I think it's a bad move. I really do. Think about it. Everything other than wrestling that WWE, and specifically, let's be honest, we're talking about Vince McMahon, has ever gotten into, has failed. You know, people forget that when he was much younger and first getting into promoting, Vince McMahon was a boxing promoter, briefly. He was a promoter, I believe, of music concerts. He helped promote an Evel Knievel event back in the 70s, I believe it was. Some sort of canyon jump. Promoted that. It flopped. Oh, it flopped something fierce. Flopped badly. He tried a football league. It failed. He tried a bodybuilding federation. It failed. He opened up, I think, multiple music labels. They failed. He opened up a films division, which is still going. It has not been the most successful thing, but it has not yet failed, per se, although in a way that it kind of has failed, because when they first started WWE Films, the goal was to take a different WWE superstar and put them in the lead role of each movie and help get them over to a wider audience. And they've already pretty much abandoned that. I mean, John Cena may be the exception, but you look at this new Randy Orton movie coming out called That's What I Am, and I feel stupid even calling it a Randy Orton movie. Orton has a small part in this movie. You could tell just by watching the trailer or the commercial for it, because Orton in the commercial is in one scene. His lines are very limited, and apparently people have seen the movie, and the reviews have not been awful. Some people have said that Orton in his part is actually pretty good, but it's a very limited role. It's a small part. It's not his movie. So they've reached a point now where, in many of these films, the WWE wrestler in the movie is not even the center of attention. They're just in the movie. So they're essentially just making movies that have absolutely nothing to do with their talent. They're just kind of sticking their talent in there into roles, however big or small they may be. And that's fine if that's the direction they want to go in, but that's not true to what their original goal was for their movies division. So again, in one respect, you could say even that that has failed. But the point to all of this is that everything Vince McMahon has ever gotten himself into, aside from wrestling, aside from WWE, has been a flop. I mean, they even tried co-promoting this Girls Gone Wild pay-per-view back in, I think, 2003, It was something that Eric Bischoff was working on, and he somehow convinced WWE to help promote it and to I think co-produce it. And again, it failed. It was a flop. So if I'm Vince McMahon, I just stick to what I know. You know, Vince McMahon is not perfect. He is not flawless. But he will go down as the most successful, probably greatest wrestling promoter that ever lived. And apparently that's not good enough for him. Or it's some sort of insult to the man. And I can't quite understand why that is. But if he knew what was good for him, he would stick to wrestling. It's what he's good at. Don't get yourself mixed up in other stuff. Just stick to what you know. And Jamie from Niagara Falls writes in. He just got done finished reading A Lion's Tale and Undisputed in succession, back to back. That's both of Chris Jericho's books. And he wanted my opinion on something. Why do I think Vince McMahon was so willing to pursue and push Chris Jericho from the get-go? As Jericho talks about in his book, he was invited to a secret WWE booking meeting while he was under contract to WCW. He made a heavily hyped debut in a verbal battle with one of the top stars in the company and was even penciled in as the main event of WrestleMania 2000 at one point. That's right. Jericho in the book points out that he was likely supposed to be part of that fatal four-way main event at WrestleMania 16 that ended up featuring Mick Foley in his spot. Jericho was even on the initial WrestleMania 2000 poster. It was The Rock, Triple H, Big Show, and Chris Jericho, and for whatever reason that got changed. Anyway, this all despite the fact that Jericho lacks Vince McMahon's prototypical size, standing at about 5'10", and was a former employee of the WWE's main competitor in WCW. Why do you think this is? Well, that's a good question. The best thing that I could come up with, I don't know what was going through Vince McMahon's mind at the time. If I ever attempted to find out what's going through Vince McMahon's mind at any moment, I could make a lot of money. It's like if my cat could suddenly dance and sing show tunes, I'd be a rich man, but that's not going to happen. It's impossible. I just remember that when Jericho was on his way out of WCW, WWF was under a lot of fan pressure to sign Jericho. There was a huge outpouring of support to WWF at the time to sign this man. People were saying how great he was. You know, he could be a big star if he were used properly. I remember Vince McMahon around that time. It would have been around the summer of 99. And I think Vince was actually asked to speak at Oxford in the UK. Oxford University. Much the same way that Dana White, the president of UFC, was recently invited to speak in Oxford. And I remember Vince being there, and I think either during his time there or as he was leaving, fans were cornering him, asking him questions. I think actually it was during maybe a Q&A session at the university. He was asked about, he was either asked, are you going to sign Jericho? Or the person said to him, you need to get this man signed to a contract. And I remember Vince's response was something along the lines of, we're trying. Which was rare, again, you know, for him to even acknowledge that. But clearly it was something that they felt a lot of pressure to do. They saw this, the kind of support that this guy had. This was not just some other, you know, replaceable mid-card nobody from WCW. This was a guy that people wanted to see. And at the time, they were still in a very bitter war, even though they were already winning the war at that point, WWF was, but they were still locked in a war with another big-time national wrestling company. And they were going to do everything in their power to take this man away from them. I think part of it, now that I think about it, also may have been the fact that, you know, Eric Bischoff opened his checkbook, or Ted Turner's checkbook, and signed a lot of guys away from WWF. Everybody from top talent like Hulk Hogan, Randy Savage, Lex Luger, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, all the way to guys like Bobby Heenan, Gene Okerlund, Ted DiBiase, who couldn't even wrestle anymore. Even Virgil, for Christ's sake, signed everybody away from WWE. Bret Hart. And here's an opportunity in Vince McMahon's mind to take one of WCW's talents away from them. That may have been part of it also. And obviously, it paid off for Jericho. If anybody reads Jericho's second book where he goes into his initial run in WWE, it was not easy for him. He went through a lot of shit, and he almost didn't make it. With some lucky breaks along the way, he ended up becoming a big star, realizing his potential, but he almost didn't. But I don't think that Jericho would regret his decision to leave WCW and go to WWF. I think things turned out pretty well for him. All right, we're going to stop right there, cinch up the old mailbag, save some for next week. If you have any questions of your own, you can email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. That's thesolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/solomonster. We're over 800 followers and counting. And facebook.com/thesolomonster. Friend me on there. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes for free. It costs you nothing. Just go into iTunes and type in Solomonster Sounds Off. That's the full name of the show. You can even leave some feedback and some star ratings for the show if you wish to do so. Hope everybody who celebrates has a very happy Easter. Be back next weekend with episode 157 of the Sound Off right here on SEScoops.com. So until then, be well, stay safe, have a great week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.